This program is part of the Cosmic Potato Podcast Network. For more shows like this, visit our website at cosmicpotato.com.
I cannot believe I'm talking like this. I'm not even sure it was real.
It is. What saved you hurt your brother. That vision changed him forever. I watched him withdraw. I saw him lose trust in other people. I watched his openness vanish.
It wasn't because of a vision. It was because of me. My presence was a danger to the family. If the logic extremists couldn't get to me, they would try to get to him. And he was my little shadow. So I had to wound him deep enough to keep them away from me.
What did you do? The fact that you're not saying anything means that you must have hurt him irreparably. Which is why the four of us can never get together, which is why you're always too busy to see each other.
I'm sorry. I am sorry for what I did. What I thought I had to do. I've reached out so many times to make amends. He's not interested. But I won't give up on him. I will find him.
No. I will.
Hi, folks, and welcome to the Discovery After Show. I am Rick, son of Sharon, and joining me tonight is Sean, son of, I don't know.
525,600 men.
You done?
Yeah, I'm done.
And John, son of somebody.
Watch it.
And Virginia, daughter of somebody.
Hello.
And Chris, daughter of none. No, wait, no. Hi, Chris.
I go by he, and I am son of Michael.
Ah.
Oh. Not Michael Burnham.
Okay. Cool. Folks, I got to tell you, I think the single greatest technological invention of all time has got to be the back scratcher. Sorry about that. But,
is that indistinguishable from magic?
Sometimes.
Indistinguishable from God.
So tonight we are talking about season 2, episode 3?
Yes.
Yes, episode 3 of Star Trek Discovery, Point of Light. And because we are now fully into the episode, and now we'll have to maybe create an edit point. I forgot to ask before we started. John, did you do a synopsis?
I did not.
Okay.
Let me pull up Wikipedia. Maybe there's one on there, and I can just read what they've got.
Yeah, the odds of me doing a summary decreased exponentially with the likelihood of me doing a game show that same night.
Sort of a bitch to summarize it, but
there was a lot happening here.
It was,
yes.
I don't mean,
and blessed election. Little to do with the we didn't go to a star point, which was
no,
interesting. Not yet.
Yes, I have a there is a synopsis here on Wikipedia. I can just read that.
Okay, I know that we tend to say we'll do like a non spoiler sort of thing, but if you're here and haven't watched the episode yet, then either love spoilers or you might maybe need to like
rethink your priorities. So,
yeah, if you're listening to a podcast that has after show in the title, then you probably want to watch the show first and then listen to this after.
So we're not going to worry about spoiler alerts anymore, I think, from henceforth. We're just going to talk about the show because that's what we do. So before we go into what we all thought of the show, Sean, why don't you regale us with a summary, pretty please?
All right. Point of Light was written by Andrew Colville and directed by Olatunde Osunsanmi. Amanda Grayson arrives aboard Discovery with a stolen copy of Spock's medical records from the psychiatric facility he has voluntarily entered. Pike orders Commander Burnham to decrypt the files. The files lead Amanda to confirm that Spock has drawn the red angel since he was a child. Burnham then tells her that to protect him from Vulcan's murderous logic extremists, she hurt Spock irreparably and caused their ongoing estrangement. Klingon Chancellor Laurel introduces Ash/Vok to the baby son she and Vok had together. Well, that's not accurate, but anyway. The leader of a Klingon house threatens to kill Ash/Vok and their son, but they kill the traitor and his men with the help of Philippa Georgiou. To consolidate power, Laurel presents fake heads of her lover and son to the Klingon High Council, with the council acclaiming her as mother of all Klingons. Georgiou takes Ash/Vok and the baby to a vessel crewed by Section 31, delivering the baby to a cloistered Klingon monastery and recruiting Ash/Vok to Section 31. A sentient spore has grown within Ensign Tilly, causing her to hallucinate that she's talking to a dead schoolmate. Burnham deduces the cause, then Stamets pulls the fungal parasite out of Tilly using dark matter. There you go.
That's not bad. That's not bad. Yeah. It's concise, as you said, a little bit inaccurate, but I think a rather skillful condensation. Oh, dear. Get that girl some honey tea, stat. We have a star date, finally, and a personal log.
Oh, yeah.
Beginning the episode. Yeah, that made me very happy hearing Michael, you know, personal log, stardate, whatever. The show is getting more and more traditionally Star Trek with every episode. Before we get into this, let's go around the table and get your quick opinion / rating, not rating, but what'd you think of the show, Virginia?
I liked it more the second time I watched it. I got to be honest, the first time I watched it, it stressed me the hell out. I was so stressed out watching it. There's way too much going on. And like one or two of the major events, like the whole baby situation or the ethics of opening Spock's medical file, both of those could have been their own episodes. Mm-hmm. I really don't think I'm going to like where they take the Spock is crazy storyline, especially now with the empathy deficit psychopath thing. But of course I'm willing to see it through and see how that goes, but my faith is rapidly diminishing. From like a fashion standpoint, I like that we could understand the Klingons a little better because of the makeup and the facial prosthetics weren't as cumbersome as they were in season one, which I think y'all kind of talked about. And I was also glad there was no return of the boob window in Klingon fashion. Shout out to Lursa and Bator. But I noticed Laurel might have been like tipping her hand to them with like the low plunging neckline. And I loved her facial jewelry. That was really awesome. And then finally, just in a totally superficial commentary, Anson Mount, Silver Fox. And also, I hate Netbeard.
Okay, John.
I didn't notice that much about what they were wearing, and I feel like I failed. let me see. So I enjoyed the episode. it was a lot. They moved. They took like some big steps on a lot of different fronts, none of which really had anything to do with the red signals. I guess tangentially, because you find out that Spock connected to them. And we'll talk more about that later. But you know, my 2 second review it was good. I guess 3 or 4 major plot lines, for some reason I felt that I was probably drawn to the Tilly one the most, which I kind of didn't want to be. not that it was bad, but I wanted to follow the big story. And I'm sure that all of these paths will intersect, but I don't know. We'll come up in discussion, I guess. We'll discuss more later.
Okay. Monsieur DeFilippis.
I liked it. I had the exact opposite experience as Virginia. I really liked it on the first watch. I thought it was exciting and, you know, chock full of like a lot of interesting things. And then on the second watch, I have to admit, I put it on last night after I got home from a Super Bowl party and I drank nothing but water. This was, you know, I was teetotaling last night and I fell asleep halfway through. There's just so much going on. And
yeah, that game was boring as hell.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah, okay. I too. And then I rewatched it again about a half an hour before we got on mic. I finished it again. And there was, I think the more I saw it, the more I immersed myself in it, the less I liked it. And I think it was because so many of the scenes were starting to show. And this, I guess, might be particular to Discovery in the sense that We're used to Star Trek, especially like next gen style Star Trek, which became very much character stories. Each episode focused on a character, and if there was some overarching plot, especially like in DS9, they would weave that into whatever character they're studying that week. This one was just cram packed with, it looked to me like scene setting, like getting things in place so that the rest of the season could play out. And I think maybe that's sort of something that is new that we sort of have to contend with in this age of streaming, you know, everything and binge watching, because they just want to tell one serialized story so that you can watch it from start to finish as almost one continuous thing, not like a series experience like we used to do. So I don't know that made the episode bad. I became more disenchanted with it upon rewatching it again and again.
Okay, I think you're absolutely right. I think part of what Discovery suffers from, if suffers is the right word, is trying to cram, you know, 26 episodes worth of story into 13.
Well, so, it's like, I don't feel like it was. I mean, it's a weird, I guess, kind of complaint, at least for me, because it's not like there was too much going on. I didn't feel like there was too much going on. I felt like they did a good job of balancing the stories that they told. But I think maybe, like I said, maybe it's because all of them were ancillary. Is that the right word I'm looking for? Ancillary to the season arc.
Yeah.
Of the Red Angel. It didn't connect. Maybe it didn't really connect.
Maybe it felt like, you know what, now that you're saying it that way, maybe it's gelling in my head what I didn't like about it upon rewatching it. It's almost like we were watching 3 B plots with no A plot.
Exactly. Yeah, well, I was just going to say they're all A plots with no B plots. But yeah, it's the same concept in that each, like the Laurel and Ash could have been a whole episode. Tilly and May could have been a whole episode, and Burnham and Amanda could have been a whole episode, or 2 or 3 or whatever. Yeah. I liked it. It's funny because until Virginia just mentioned it being very busy
or what I know that's not what you said, but essentially that there was a lot in there, and I agreed with you. The first time I watched it, I felt like, wow, that was a lot to process.
Mm-hmm.
The second time I watched it, which was this afternoon or earlier this evening, I didn't feel that. I liked it more the second time. And then I've even watched some bits of it more because my wife and I were watching it together, which was my second viewing, her first, and then we had some technical issues, and then the child didn't go to sleep. So I finished the episode, my wife went and laid down with our little girl, and then about half an hour ago she came out and I restarted the episode for her. So while I was waiting to start this show, I was kind of watching over her shoulder. So I saw some bits again. The performances are really compelling. We'll get into some more detail about what I think they're setting up a lot of this stuff for, but it didn't feel as crammed a second time to me, which maybe, you know, kind of like what you were saying, Virginia, I was like, really, you're so tensed and trying to just process all of the information they're throwing at you the first time through. The second time you can just sort of relax and go, all right, I know the broad strokes. Now I can pay attention to the details.
Right. When I was watching it the first time, a lot of it was like when Laurel starts kissing Tyler and says, you know, want me back. And I'm like, oh my God, they're going to do this thing where he falls in love with the woman that like sexually assaulted him. And this is going to be terrible. But then later he's like, no, that was a violation. And so there were all of these scenes that set up like, okay, they're going to eventually get around to where it's okay. But like having so many of those in one episode, watching it the second time, already knowing, okay, it's going to be fine. This is just the plot to get to the next point. It wasn't as stressful for me.
Got it.
Yeah. I kind of liked that when he confronted her with it being a violation, because that was Ash talking. I don't think that Vok would have seen her. He even said, when you touch me, I should feel the way, you know, Vok did. But to me now, who I am now, who you made me, I just feel violated. He doesn't want to like chastise her for it because of who he was, but at the same time he can't help feeling that way now. It was very interesting. And I'm sorry, John. I know that you wanted to chime in.
No, I shouldn't have interrupted. I was going to say that I liked her response to him saying that. Like, she was horrified at the thought that she was violating him, as opposed to, you know, trying to force herself on him or he'll get over
it. Get some of that ash.
Wow.
She wants to get some of that ash.
Go back to your room.
Yeah. This is how you come back to
mute him. Just mute him right now.
Okay, Sean, we've all given our 30-second review. What did you think of the episode?
There wasn't anything in the episode that I didn't like. I mean, I liked everything that happened, but I kind of feel like they're dragging their feet telling the overall story because there's characters that we've met briefly and never gotten back to, and there's characters that we know that are going to have part of the season that we're three episodes in and haven't seen yet, like number one hasn't shown up yet. You know, Pike's up. I think she's going to be in the next one. And we haven't seen
Jet Reno. She's in the next one, too.
Is she going to be in the next one, too? Yeah, it just feels like this episode didn't feel like filler. I mean, it felt like everything that was there needed to be there to tell the story. It just felt like it could have been split up and put in some other episodes that had more of the overall plot and a little more action and things like that in it, I guess. But
I did notice that there was a lot of standing around talking, which may not necessarily be a Discovery hallmark, but it sure as hell is Star Trek. So.
Yeah. Yeah.
I didn't mind it. Yeah. I mean, I have heard people say
Now, this is from the buzz I'm hearing online, probably the divisive isn't really the right word, but, you know, episodes one and two were universally exalted from what I was hearing. I'm ignoring the Discovery haters. I just don't care anymore. If you don't watch it, fine. Go wank off to.
Oh, Orville. they had a field day with the Klingons this week. I'm telling you.
but damn, I lost my train of thought.
Because you got distracted by the haters, and therefore the haters win.
I did. I know.
You were talking about episodes one and two being more universally sort of Star Trek beloved, kind of like return to form, and then this one being more divisive.
Yeah, and I don't remember the point I was trying to make. I'm sorry.
I can only take you to that far, buddy.
It is a Monday. It's late here on my side of the country.
Well, I'll say this. Just expanding on that thought, Rick, with the haters and a lot of the I cannot read Trek movie comment sections anymore because it's just rife with haters.
Yeah.
But a lot of people were complaining that this seemed to be a return to season one in tone and in style. And they were really kind of bummed about that because they loved the planet side story in episode two and sort of the more adventurous exploration that took place in episode one, which they feel is more akin to their Star Trek. So I can see where people might think, oh, no, we're falling back, especially if you weren't especially a fan of season one. To me, it's all just Discovery, and they are going to touch back on the Klingon homeworld. They're going to touch back on the Section 31 stuff. They're going to touch back on a lot of the threads that they built into that first season. They'd be silly not to because they're building their own universe here.
Yeah.
Did anybody have that issue? Did you think, oh, no, at any point?
You know, I love Klingons. I've always loved the Klingons. You know, we've had some serious changes from TOS through TMP, through, TNG and lots more initials I can throw around. I've always loved the Klingons. I've loved what they do. You know, John Colicos, I still think is the greatest Klingon ever. His core, both in TOS and in Deep Space Nine. I think he just was the most wonderful Klingon ever. But we've seen a progression of differences, mostly due to the fact that it was budgetary. And I think what a lot of people are complaining about with this episode, they don't like what Discovery is doing with the Klingons. I don't care. I love what they're doing with the Klingons. It's very clear that they are steering it toward the Klingons, quote unquote, that we know. What was his name? Kolchak? No.
Kolshaw.
Kolshaw,
yeah.
Very much closer to the TNG, the TNG style Klingons.
Yeah.
It's very clear that we're dealing with multiple species of Klingon, which I love. I've said it before. I said it a few times back during our season one shows. The Klingon Empire has never been an empire. It's always been one species that we encounter. Where's the rest of the quote unquote empire? Now we're seeing that all of the different houses are different species. Did you notice in the fight we saw different colors of blood?
Mm-hmm.
You know. People have always
whined about none of it was pink though.
No, there was one of them. I watched really close the second time I watched it because I wanted to check. In Star Trek VI, The Undiscovered Country,
the Pepto-Bismol.
Pepto-Bismol.
I was thinking blueberry yogurt, but yeah. There's a lot of apocryphal stories about it, about why it was that way. The main story that people seem to cling to is that in order to keep their PG or PG-13 rating, they couldn't have red blood for that scene, and that's not true.
I always thought that that was the truth. So then what was it, Rick? Enlighten us, please.
In Nicholas Meyer's book, The View from the Bridge, he says, I could get the page, but I quoted it on something a couple, like last year, but I don't. What happened was the special effects team went for that color because it looked alien, and he didn't have time to see it. So the first time he saw it was when they premiered. And so it was not a conscious decision to avoid an R rating or something like that. It's just somebody in the visual effects department went, well, they're aliens, so let's give them weird colored blood. And that's just what happened.
Okay. I never especially minded that. I just thought it made them more alien. So.
Yeah. I thought it was, my first thought was, okay, that's a weird color for blood, but okay. And then, of course, Star Trek fans being Star Trek fans, and I am not setting myself apart from that because I have obsessed over stupid minutiae in the past and myself. But everybody has to start going, well, why, and get their magnifying glasses out and stuff. But I really got a kick out of the fact that there were several different shades of blood in that scene. Another thing I really liked, and this is a completely technical thing. The first scene on the bridge where Michael comes on board up onto the bridge, and it's a yellow alert because the Vulcan ship is coming in, but they don't know what it is yet. Mm-hmm. And the shot was beautiful because it's clearly a handheld camera, probably a Steadicam, but it goes all the way around the bridge. Does a full 360 around the bridge and then finishes on the command chair. Which one of the things that TOS pioneered was the fact that the bridge set was made of what they call a bunch of wild sections, meaning that any section of the bridge could be removed so they could bring a camera in. But nowadays cameras aren't these huge, 250-pound things on pedestals. They're they can be handheld easily enough. So unless there was some CG wizardry there, they were just going around the whole entire complete bridge set with the camera, which I thought was really cool.
But do you think there's maybe too much of a good thing in this episode when it comes to that? Because the camera work in this was just a little excessive. Swoops and turns and angles and upside downs and right side ups. And
I liked the upside downs for sorry, go ahead, John.
No, I was just agreeing. Every scene started off upside down. And you didn't really need that right there.
Yeah, that was strange. It kind of went sideways.
Maybe that's why Virginia was stressed.
Vertigo.
I liked it some of the times. Eventually it was like, all right, look, just stop it.
But you know what? Honestly, if I got to direct a Discovery episode, I'm sure I would do that.
Just I would have effects in
every shot.
The visual of when Michael and Ash were talking via hologram, the way that they shot that, I thought was visually appealing.
Yeah, that was sweet.
It reminded me of
where he was. Jedi. I mean, they would cut from, solid person. Now this person's a hologram, and now we're seeing her in her quarters, and we're seeing him in his ship at the same time, and getting the abstract of what's surrounding them and stuff. And it was pretty cool.
All right, Sean, I apologize, but I'm about to give you an edit point.
Okay.
D motherfucking 7.
I don't know what that means.
The ship, the Klingon battle cruiser, the D7 battle cruiser.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I was going to make a 7 of 9 joke.
Sorry, I love that ship. I think that the D7 is the second greatest thing that Matt Jeffries ever designed. The first one, of course, being the original Enterprise. But I love the Enterprise. I love the Klingon battlecruiser. And the fact that they are that – because one of my biggest – problem isn't the right word. Grin and bear it things. Stressors about Discovery is the ships. And I know I'm not alone, but I know we're a minority of those of us that just are so into the hardware. You know, the rectangular warp nacelles and the fucking window. but the Klingon ships have been, you know, I haven't said much about it. I don't think. Have I? If I have, I'm sorry. You know, I know they're putting their, you know, they're wanting to put their own stamp on it. And, you know, the Klingon ships that we've seen thus far kind of look more like Cylons than Klingons, but whatever. But, you know, when Burnham and every or when Lorca got captured and the computer said it was a D7. And I I know you all heard me bitch about that. but this is the D7. This is the Klingon battlecruiser. This is the ship that I grew up watching the Klingons fly, and I'm just so happy to see it.
Well, I like the fact that they pointed out that it was going to be the symbol of a unified empire, and it really points up what you just said about, Rick, them being all different species that are all competing houses with varying ships that, I guess, whatever resources your house can muster is you'd build your own ships based on that, and that's why there was such wildly varied designs of the Klingon ships. They look nothing like we expect the Klingon ship to look. And I'm thinking that when Ash said the symbol of the unified Klingon Empire, it really helped bring that continuity point home for me in a way that is very interesting, you know, and not just retconning to shut the fans up, but in a way that fits organically into the show that they're putting on.
You know, I think that's the point I was trying to make earlier. Thank you. Is they are beautifully bringing things towards the show, the canon we're used to, the look, the feel, the stuff. You know, we're getting uniforms, we're getting Klingons that are starting to look more like what we're used to. We're getting the D7, you know, being conceptualized here. Yeah, they're not like exactly. It's not like fan servicey. It's all working organically. Yes, that's thank you for saying what I was trying to say, but far more eloquently.
It's what I do.
Well, do we want to talk about the? I mean, we've talked about the Klingons a lot. Do we want to talk about the plot point for the Klingons being there? What we saw happen with Laurel and Ash.
Nah.
I've been looking forward to recording this episode because I am sure that like everyone knows who that baby grows up to be except for me. Or who the mother is, like the significance of her being called the mother. That's not a thing.
Nope.
I don't.
Cause they built it up like it was a thing. Like he will not know his parents. I'm like, okay, well, who's that kid? Like, dude, I was waiting to find out. I didn't look it up intentionally because I wanted to be educated on the show. So thanks for nothing, guys.
I'm not a Klingon historian, but I don't remember anything about a albino Klingon baby from TNG a history monastery. Or anything like that.
Well,
yeah.
Okay, go ahead, Virginia.
I was kind of getting sort of a historical parallel between Laurel and Elizabeth I, because she said she was married to the country and the citizens were her children. And she was one of the greatest rulers of, you know, medieval England. So to me, I connected that where she's going to come and be like this great leader for a long time. I thought maybe that was the parallel they were trying to draw.
Well, people are saying that the baby is going to grow up to be the albino that Korkang and Koloth and Curzon Dax were going after. I don't see that happening.
Well, I went down that path too, and I say, you know, you're dealing with Section 31. They're very duplicitous. Do you know that baby got beamed to Boreth? They just, I mean, why wouldn't Ash bring him down to the monastery in person? So who knows really what's the fate of that baby?
Well, he couldn't bring him down to the monastery because, well, I guess they could have.
I mean,
he's
supposed to be dead and no one can see him. But I guess
Section 31 has apparently you have wearable tech that can put a fake like hollow image around you.
True.
I want to talk about that.
Yeah, but I mean, so what I'm saying is that I am very suspicious as to whether or not that baby ever made it to the monastery. And I was reading, now this is not canon, but J.G. Hertzler wrote a book called Left Hand of Destiny, which dealt with the Klingon Empire after DS9. It's part of the relaunch series. And a lot of it takes place on Boreth. And I'm racking my brains to figure out if there was an albino in that, but it never, you know, the book came out years and years and years ago. So there's no connection there. That's just me being, you know, Chris of old saying, how does this reconcile?
are the monks on Boreth the ones that clone Kalis?
Yes.
Okay.
See, that's what I was thinking. I was wondering if he was, I don't know, they use his genetic material somehow. Not that they killed the baby. I figured the baby would grow up to be something or someone that we know about. But
yeah, no, it is, as far as anything that we've seen in the past, Laurel and Valk and the baby are brand new.
I'm glad to see the man bun made it to the future.
He can always get a job working in a Starbucks if the Section 31 thing doesn't work out.
The thing with Chris mentioned the wearable tech that Section 31 has. So, number one, Georgiou's appearance in this episode would have been a lot better if they had not used it in all their promotional images for the season.
I know, right?
That costume that she was wearing and stuff. But why does she need a holographic mask if she's got her face covered with a hood? Because as soon as she pulls the hood off, the mask disappears. So why did you have it on?
Well, I'm fine with that. I mean, that's better disguising. Because people assume if you got a hood over your face, then that's your real face. So she's got a double layer of disguise. My question would be, why bother with the disguise if you're going to kill everybody in the room?
Yeah. Yeah, and that fight was, I mean, it was a good fight scene. It was choreographed pretty well, but that was the most intense and gruesome fight that I think I've ever seen in Star Trek.
Yeah.
It was a lot of blood.
As it should be.
Well, that's what a Klingon fight should look like. Yeah. And
especially if you're fighting for your newborn baby. Like, they're, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then at the end of the episode, when Laurel basically got in front of the High Council and told them that the leader of House Kor actually saved her life and that Ash had killed her baby, and so she killed Ash. And then she held Ash's head up and she held the baby's head up. When she held the baby's head, my heart sank because I thought that was, because Virginia had put something on the Facebook group that we talked through and said that something big had happened or whatever. And when they showed that, I was like, is that what she's talking about? They killed the baby and they killed Ash? And then I put in the group, I said, holy forking shirt balls. And then I watched one more scene and I was okay.
As soon as we saw the baby's head, I was like, that baby isn't there. There's no way he would show that if it was real.
Yeah.
Real. Quote unquote real.
Well, yeah, and she wouldn't have, I mean, she is saying what happened and we know that she's lying. So I assume from that point on that all of it was deceit.
I got a kick out of on one of the Facebook groups I'm on. Somebody was complaining, they're like, you know, I understand that it wasn't real, but did we really have to see the baby's head? And I was like, is there a nice way to show a dead baby?
Yeah, really.
And you got to figure, I mean, what I loved about the Klingon thing here is something that actually I didn't like maybe one of the few things I liked upon the second watching it again that I actually got more appreciation for is just what a miserable friggin' place Kronos is. Who would want to live there? I mean, it looks like the the council hall is built on Mount Doom because she dropped Ash's head into the lava. So it must be. And then I thought, wait a minute, they're so alien and they're so Klingon that to them this place might be beautiful. This might be like paradise. They might go to Risa and say, "What the ever luffin' F?" So because they evolved to live there, and I was thinking, like, it's a nice choice, even though it fits in with sort of the Klingon mythos, to make it harsh and uninviting, but it aesthetically and as maybe trying to make it even more alien, having them live in this and not trying to brighten it up in any way. It's just their reality. And it reminded me of one of the books that I read in the Star Trek tie-in novel series where one of the authors posited that Klingons can see a little bit further down on the color spectrum than we can. So to them, you know, they know colors that we will never know. And maybe that's what they're seeing when they look out at Kronos. So it was another thing that set my mind on like a fan tangent, and I kind of liked it.
Yeah, that follows. Okay. We have dealt with the Klingon storyline pretty well. Let's talk about some of the other stuff that went on. Have I mentioned lately how much I love this Amanda?
Oh yeah.
She's great. You know, I think, you know, Jane Wyatt did a fantastic job of creating Amanda from nothing. But Mia Kirshner is just running with this character and I love it. When she gave Burnham that kiss on the cheek and said no, it was like the classic steel fist in a velvet glove in just that one syllable. She's just amazing. I love this character so much.
Yeah, I like the way that she dealt with Pike, that she you know, he said, did she argue this much growing up? Or
she, you know, was she this feisty growing up?
Yeah. And he said, we call it, what did she say, persistent, yes. I think? And she got that from me.
Yeah.
It was a cool line. I also liked the fact that one thing that didn't happen a whole lot in season one that is happening now is that Michael was asked to do something wrong. You know, Amanda wanted her to break into this file that she stole from Starbase 5, and she went and asked the captain's permission before she did it, because last season she wouldn't have done that. She wouldn't have hesitated. She would have just done it. So she's growing as a character.
Yeah. Well, she said that last time, you know, last episode, that, you know, she's learned that not following orders has some pretty stiff consequences.
Yeah.
But I really love the scenes between Michael and Amanda. Something tells me that when we find out what Michael did, it's not going to be as big a deal as she thinks it is.
Oh, I know what it is.
You do?
She told Spock about Cybok. And he just couldn't handle it.
Could be.
I was wondering when we're going to get any kind of mention, if we're going to get any kind of mention of Cybok in this. And if Vulcan is like a logic society, how do they have royalty?
I saw somebody on one of the Facebook groups that were hypothesizing all the kinds of stuff. And they said, I think we're going to find out that who they think is Spock is not really Spock, but it's Cybok in disguise. And I'm like, no, that would ruin the show. I don't think I'd watch it anymore if they did that.
Yeah, that would be... I would be very happy to never hear about freaking Scott Cybok ever again.
It's canon, Rick.
I know.
Why does God need a starship? He needs a starship with a spore drive.
So then let's talk about Tilly and her not so friendly ghost.
Oh, I wanted to mention one more thing. Go with that storyline. I love the subtle way that they're kind of addressing the obvious. I mean, it's obvious that this show has more advanced technology than the original series because, you know, it's 2019. Yeah. Yeah. But you know, the haters love to come up and say, yeah, well, why did the technology take a step back, you know, 10 years later or whatever. I'm like, shut up. But, when Pike gets on that call with the guy from Starbase 5, and the guy says, you know, you and my grandmother are the only ones that still talk on screens. Everyone else is using holograms. It's like, just wait.
Can we linger on the Amanda question?
Sure.
Some speculation. I mean, okay, so she came to Michael because Michael apparently is the only person in the galaxy that can decode Spock's personal files. I mean, I'm sure someone at the Vulcan Science Academy might have been able to do it too, but I understand wanted to keep it in the family. So she leaves. Where's she going? What's her end game? She's going to find Spock. She's going to infiltrate Starbase 5. She's going to what's her? Can someone tell me? Because she just said, I'll handle it and left. Well,
I'm wondering if there's going to be some kind of rescue mission later. They're going to have to save Amanda because she's got herself into some kind of trouble.
I hope they don't do that. I really hope
they don't do that.
I mean, Amanda is the wife of a very prominent diplomat. So she can go places, like when, at the beginning of the episode, when her ship was approaching the Discovery and Saru's like, yeah, it's a diplomatic ship and that's all they have to tell us. And we kind of have to do what they say. They didn't say that, but, even today, diplomats can get away with a whole lot of stuff that average people can't.
Am I the only one thinking Lethal Weapon 2 now?
Well, this has also turned into more of a, it was a search for Spock. Spock is missing. We got to find him kind of thing. Now it's we got to find Spock. He's a fugitive. He's wanted for murder now. So we have to find him before, he gets captured and put into prison or whatever.
I mean, I don't buy the fact that he killed five people.
Oh no, I don't think he did it either. That's what they were kind of wanting to go both ways. Well, maybe he did it because he's in some kind of an emotional state, or maybe he's being accused of something that he didn't do. I think it's the latter.
Course it is. Yeah. So and it sounds like Section 31 is trying to set him up for it for some reason.
So apparently,
and we did find out that
if you hit the mute button on your mic when you talk, people can't hear you.
Nobody can hear you.
Turns out, I was like, hey, why is everybody being a dick? I'm trying to make a point. Oh. So apparently, in my infinite wisdom, I turned it off and turned it back on again and forgot about it. And now I forget what I was going to say. Oh, we're talking about Amanda and
Michael.
Oh, right. So I said, I could watch Vulcan solve crimes all day. And nobody really replied. But I was like, okay, all right, fine. But yeah, just I like the way that they just went through logically, okay, well, it's either this or this or this or this. And clearly they were emotional about it, but they approached it with complete logic. I would like to see more of that. Once the Vulcan cop show.
I did like that we found out that, there's been this question of what did Michael do that made Spock so upset that he didn't want to talk to her anymore. And we find out that whatever it is that she did it on purpose to protect him from the Vulcan extreme, the extremists.
Logic extremists. Or whatever. Which is the
logic extremists
that was coming after her. Anyone's ever come up with.
Doesn't that go back to Enterprise, though?
It goes back to TNG, the episode was Gambit, and it was one of those ones that had a two-part episode, had a great first part where Picard and Riker are undercover on a smuggler vessel, and it looks like things are going to be great, and Robin Curtis plays a Klingon, or a Vulcan, or she's pretending to be a Romulan, but she's actually a Vulcan. And then the whole thing collapses into love will save the world sort of thing. And just dies a terrible death. But that's where the logic extremist came from, which makes no freaking sense whatsoever.
Can I ask a question to Virginia? And yes. Maybe I'm going to assume on behalf of like Rick and Sean and John being so long Star Trek fans, You said during your recap initially that the thought that Spock might be suffering from some empathy deficiency and that he murdered five people. I mean, were you initially afraid that that was the truth? Because I think that for the four of us watching on this end, we were just like, yeah, no.
No, it was, that was one of the stressful times for me because I'm like, clearly Spock wouldn't have done this. So these people are painting someone now as not only crazy, but a violent crazy person, which is going to make it even like that just adds on a whole other layer of awfulness when trying to find someone, especially if like law enforcement or the military is trying to find them. So to me, it was more like, oh, God, this is going to get 20 times worse when they're looking for him than, oh, yeah, Spock, of course, I wouldn't have thought he would have done something like that.
Okay, thanks for clarifying. I'm just curious to get your thought on that. Yeah,
it's just that this is not anywhere near the first time that we've had a storyline of a main character is being accused of a murder. I mean, they did it in Voyager, they did it in TNG. I just watched the TOS episode 2 days ago where Scotty was accused of killing the belly dancer.
Oh, I forgot about that.
Wolf in the Fold. Yeah. Yep. Red Jack, Red Jack, Red Jack.
So, you know, they've done that.
That had John Fiedler in it.
The voice of Piglet.
And he's also...
That's where I've heard that voice before.
He's also Vinny on the
Uncut. I know his voice from somewhere.
Ah.
I don't know if we discussed this in the Amanda Burnham section or in the Red Angel section, but as it is a crossover point... Effectively, the Red Angels, you know, Burnham was the subject of a rescue mission when she was a kid and she got lost. So, you know, the Red Angel appeared to Spock and told him where she was. So that's twice, effectively, as far as we know, that this entity or entities have intervened on her behalf because it saved her on the... Well, I don't know. I guess it's debatable whether or not it saved her, the first episode.
It was just there. Unless it helped Pike find her.
But. That's what I was saying. Maybe it was, you know, the intuition that says go left instead of right. I don't know. There's just a lot of... I guess, so here's my question. Is this all about Burnham? Do they need her specifically for something? And they're drawn to Discovery because she's on Discovery.
Because she's the emissary.
Or something.
Well, you know, something I've been curious about feels like a dropped thread. I hope they pick it up again at some point, is that investigating these things totally frag the Enterprise. But Discovery is getting a pass.
Right.
And I'm wondering if you're not too far off of why.
Because they need Burnham or they need the Discovery. Yeah. It may not be Burnham that they need as much as they need a Discovery. But
that was my initial thinking, and that's honestly, I hope that it is about the ship and maybe even the connection to the Spore.
Well, but then why would the Angel reach out to Spock and drive him nuts? Now, this is what I've been having
I'm thinking that it wasn't so much that it was reaching out to him, but being Vulcan, he was more sensitive, and being half human, he was more empathic. So he kind of had the best of both worlds. Burnham couldn't pick it up because she's not telepathic, and Sarah couldn't pick it up because he has no empathy, but you know what I'm saying? Like his emotional
best. Well, what I like about this is that I don't mind that wrinkle of like the Angels like being like calling out to Spock or Spock not even that Spock being able to perceive a message from them, because we have future precedent for that in the motion picture with V'ger. What I don't like about this, if it does happen to be centered around Spock and Burnham, it's almost getting to be like Star Wars, where you have a giant galaxy, but only one freaking family matters.
Agreed.
And it would be really small to me and a great disappointment if the entire Red Angel thing is some kind of weird thing that's completely focused on Burnham as the Nexus, because that is not Star Trek at all.
I would have been fine with it if it was like the series long arc, and it's always been like the story is about her because this is her story. But she's already played like a huge role in the galaxy with, you know, by being the mutineer and starting the war. So like, if it just so happens that every major event of the pre-Kirk series season or era, you know, is because she did it, that would kind of suck. And I expect better from them, honestly.
Okay, we're running a little long here, so let's talk about Tilly and her friendly ghost, or not so friendly ghost, or blob monster, or whatever you want to call it.
Friendly parasite.
It was funny. My wife was watching, and the first time that May was like, "No, that's not the captain. The captain is shorter and blonder and whiter," and she's like, "Oh, she's talking Stamets." I didn't even make that connection right away,
because she's a manifestation of a spore from the mirror universe. But Stamets in the mirror universe wasn't a captain.
No,
he was the chief engineer.
But from her perspective, he was the one who did everything. He was the one that she saw, or it saw.
Yeah, I guess that's true. Yeah.
But is she talking about mirror Stamets?
I'm assuming so, because she's from the mirror universe.
Mirror Stamets is dead.
But she doesn't know.
Well, he is now.
So she might not know
that.
And also, it's the mycelial network. Does it belong in any one universe? It spans the multiverse. So from her point of view, does it make a difference? Would she be looking for? She'd just be looking for the Stamets that was driving along the mycelial network that had the connection.
Or a Stamets that was driving along.
I would say that's our Stamets is the way that I looked at it. So, you know, I don't know that because that it was, quote, from the mirror universe. Now, I think it just happened that spore fell on Tilly while they were in the mirror universe. I don't know that it's a mirror spore. I think John, like any access to the mycelium network is potential access to the entire network. You don't have one path that say like that Stamets had, then the other path that
premium lane.
Yeah, exactly.
Mycelial Express.
Well,
yeah.
I thought that there was a line. I thought that there was a line that they dropped that spelled out that the reason that this spore reacted differently was because it was different. It was from.
It was a mirror universe spore.
She spelled out that it was mirror.
Yeah, universe. It wasn't cleansed in their detox.
Why didn't everybody in engineering then, because it was all over the bay, there were spores of plenty raining down on everything and everyone.
But that was the only one that attached.
There's germs all over, you know, the elevator, but that doesn't mean everybody gets sick.
because if it reacted to the spores in the regular universe... Then when they brought that asteroid into the ship, you know, that ship is full of spores. They got a spore drive. So when they brought that asteroid in, if it had have reacted with all the spores, it would have destroyed the ship immediately.
But it wasn't. Well, all right. So I guess here's the question. My personal theory, it's not that it's just a spore. It was at that point, you know, it's the difference between a seed and a sapling. It had already landed in her and begun to grow. And it was kind of kickstarted. The sentient part of it was kickstarted and able to interact with her mind because of the ore or whatever. But it's not just that it was a spore. It was a spore that had already integrated itself into her system.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now, I have to say...
My first clue... I'm sorry.
I loved Stamets... When he's like, he says, "All right, we'll draw it out of you using this thing. By the way, this is going to hurt." Zap.
Yeah.
I was a little.
My first
at
clue.
At least give it a bullet that, bite on or something.
My first clue that she obviously is not a ghost was in the very first scene that she was in when Tilly's running down the hallway and that they're doing a half marathon through the ship. She runs through her and May kind of it knocks her back.
Yeah.
You know, when she runs through her. And if she were a ghost, it'd be like in Quantum Leap, whenever Sam would like walk through Al. Al didn't move. He just stood there. You know, he was a hologram. So she ran through her and it knocked her back. And it's like, well, she's actually there. She's an actual life.
One could also argue, not to get, it's a bit of a tangent, but I'm just saying. If I was non-corporeal, and somebody ran through me, even though it might not physically affect me, I would still react as if it did because I would expect it to. It's like when you say ouch when something doesn't really hurt. So her reacting that way doesn't necessarily mean that there was a physical impact upon her. Not that I care, to be perfectly honest.
I thought it was just maybe an actor choice and not really...
Yeah.
Now, one thing I do like about this whole Tilly thread here, and kind of going back to something you said at the beginning, Chris, about how things were sort of compressed, is one kind of storyline I don't like is you're the only one that can see me, and we're going to draw this out for a long time of you being the only one that can see me and you talking to nobody and people thinking you're crazy, et cetera, et cetera. I'm so glad they wrapped that up really fast because I hate that stuff.
And that is to me one of the most egregious sins of the TNG era style Trek, where you as a viewer have figured it out by the first 10 minutes in Act 1, yet you have to sit through the big reveal in Act 3. When you knew that, you know, only Miles was seeing Rumpelstiltskin or whatever the blankety blank, you know, they came up with that week. And it always annoyed me with Trek that it's just like, we all know where this is going. Just get there.
Yeah.
So I'm right with you there, buddy. Just dispense with that nonsense.
That was actually one of my
I was kind of getting tired of the conversations that Tilly was having with Saru, because it's like three times so far, Tilly does something crazy, Saru comes and gets onto her, and then she says, am I out of the training program? No, not yet. Does something crazy, am I out of the training program? No, not yet. It's like, what does it take to get kicked out of this program?
Well, can I don't know if it's going to be dropping a bomb, but everybody's on and on about how Michael, the haters, I should say, are on and on about how Michael is just a Mary Sue. Is Tilly kind of a Mary Sue?
I don't think so. I don't, to me, those terms just really shouldn't apply. Like, this isn't a regular place. You know what I'm saying? It's not like you're in high school and, you know, they're amazingly smart to be in high school. This is where the smartest people are.
Yeah.
So the fact that they come up with smart stuff, they're on the science vessel.
Yeah.
Like they're like, you know, cutting edge, state of the art, top technology people. So yeah, they come up with stuff like that.
It's a ship full of Mary Sue's.
Yeah, I guess you're gonna put it that way.
But sure. Rick put it very succinctly in last week's show. He said, well, all this is going on, you know, but that doesn't bother me because that's just Starfleet. You're looking at the cream of the crop, the exceptional of the exceptional. That's why they're there. So maybe it's just a loaded question. It just seems to me that so much shade has been thrown on the character of Burnham that Tilly's been getting kind of a pass because everybody likes her. But some of the traits that they give her have started to grate on me a little bit. And I'm hoping that this whole thing with the spore drive, again, goes towards that journey of evening her out a little bit, mellowing her out a little bit. I don't know. It struck me today that we don't really examine her character that much beyond the superficial.
Well, Tilly is Mitch from Top Secret, if that helps.
Not at all.
No.
Oh.
Not even a little
children.
Bit.
Jeez.
I've seen Top Secret.
Oh, okay. I don't remember anybody's name.
I don't know what the hell you're talking about.
I remember the boots. Boots? Wait.
Wrong goddamn movie. Sorry.
It was not the cow it. And Matrix.
Real genius. Yeah. Genius.
That I didn't see.
Okay, yeah.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Was Real Genius, is that the one with Fisher Stevens?
That's the one with Val Kilmer.
No.
It was the one with Val Kilmer and...
I think maybe I'm thinking...
the popcorn. My the guy who was, in the movie.
The guy who was the jerk.
Steve Martin.
Yes, My Science Project was...
Steve Martin had Fisher Stevens. Real Genius.
Not that jerk. Not the jerk. A jerk. The guy who plays the jerk. The guy who played the jerk in every 80s movie.
Oh, the guy that played in Ghostbusters as Peck, yeah.
Anyway, sorry,
not that guy. Yes, that guy, but he was the teacher. He wasn't the guy that we're talking about.
Yeah,
Mitch was a very smart boy.
Mitch was a 13-year-old who got admitted to MIT because he was a genius. And never mind. I'm sorry. I derailed us.
No, I'm sorry. I think I started the train off the track, so I apologize.
My 80s-ness is showing. But I also love that Michael didn't disbelieve Tilly. You know, we got the requisite I'm yelling at the ghost behind you, not you, Captain scene, and then we got Michael going, all right, let's find out what's really going on here. And they wrapped it up, and I really like that.
Oh yeah, she Sherlocked that out because she just because Tilly said, "Oh, she doesn't know what crying is." Well, wait a minute, you know, and then she figured it all out just because of that one line.
Well, she logic it. I mean, I was fine with it.
Yeah.
So there's I have a correction to make. Last week, I mentioned some concern over the fact that. Gretchen Berg and Aaron Harberts were let go after the fifth episode, and some worry about where the series would be going after that. I found out, and I did some research on it. They did not write a New Eden or New Eden, nor did they write this one. So my concerns are decreasing. I mean, they were executive producing and stuff, but, you know, for some reason I was under the impression that they wrote the first five episodes, and that is not true.
I think they were supervising the writers.
Well, yeah.
Where the story was being put together from, but yeah.
Apparently supervising with full whips and iron boots.
Yeah. are we supposed to pretend like Laurel has a completely different shaped head now?
She has hair.
Because she has hair, yeah. But that, I mean, I've seen some side-by-side pictures of her from last season, and the whole back of her head is completely smaller now.
I mean, they changed
the answer to your question is yes. Yes. That is no big
But also, the Klingons grew their hair back, and they're explaining that is because they shaved their head during wartime. But the season premiere picks up right after the season finale. They haven't had time to grow that much hair.
Dude, Alexander went from being 5 years old to being 21 in about 8 years.
We don't know how fast
Klingons grow hair.
Mm-hmm.
I guess they could have stimulated their hair follicles.
Well, I mean,
we saw that on the Orville this week.
They might just grow hair fast. You know.
Yeah.
They have to shave three times a day during wartime.
Yeah. they have follicular redundancy.
Just like the rest of their physiology, right?
Exactly.
But all the Klingons are suddenly speaking English. And I know that they're actually speaking Klingon, but that it seems like I didn't have a problem with the subtitles from last season. It seems like they're doing this now to satisfy some of the hatred they got last season, which if that's the case, you know, that's fine. Go ahead, do whatever. But, you know, just all of a sudden, the Klingons are all, you know, they're speaking English. And they show she's speaking Klingon, and then the subtitles turn into Klingon, and she's speaking English. So you're supposed to know that she's still speaking Klingon. We just understand
it. Which I have no problem with whatsoever.
Yeah, me too.
I just hate to see Discovery cave in to people.
I didn't see it that way. I figured it was just... To me, they are equivalent. And... If they wanted, yeah, you know what? It's like the scene where the holograms were talking to each other. You know, it's you can show it kind of one way, you can show it kind of the other way, but you basically you understand that it's the same thing. It's I'm fine with it.
You know, I don't mind subtitles either, but I also like to be able to watch the actors and not have to keep reading the bottom of the screen. So it's like The Hunt for Red October. I liked how they did it because they kind of took a page out of The Hunt for Red October, which had that brilliant thing where they're talking in Russian and then they zoom in on the Putin. His name was Putin. His mouth, and then he just switched to English, and you realize that that's just, you know, they're still speaking in Russian, quote unquote, but we're not going to have to watch subtitles for the rest of the movie. And I think it's a good choice. You know, some of the things that people complained about, I don't think were completely off target. And if you're going to have, a section of the show that's as important and as pervasive as the Klingons, yes, it's great to have them use the language every now and then. But it's also good to make it a little more accessible to everybody else, because not everyone can read very fast. And, you know, I read a lot faster than my wife. And sometimes when we're watching movies where subtitles are involved, I have to pause so that she can catch up. And I have a tendency, I don't know if anyone else has this thing. If there are subtitles on the screen, even if it's like, I just turned on the closed captioning because I couldn't catch a particular word. I stare at the words and I miss a lot of what's going on the screen. That's why like YouTube videos drive me crazy when you can't turn off the captions.
I just thought it as a good economy of storytelling. I mean, you don't have to worry about being distracted by the fact that everybody's speaking Klingon. You can just get right into it. And that's, I mean, really, what's it about? Is it about being authentic in the fake language? Or is it about getting...
Track fans, yes.
I guess. I don't know. I mean, I liked... What really jazzed me about that entire thing was that it was a very subtle aside, but Federation Standard is now canon. It's English. Because, you're going to speak in standard? Yeah, that's what you need me to do. And then when Vox says, why do you speak to me in English? When you do, it just diminishes me in front of them.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, I don't know that we've ever really established that standard is English. It's always been sort of supposed in the novels and stuff. But as a novel geek, I liked that little bit of it.
See, I never really thought in terms of standard because everybody had the translator. Mm-hmm. I figured everyone just spoke what they felt like speaking.
Well, in the books, Federation Standard is the language that, you know, they speak, so to speak, and it's sometimes interchangeable with English. So it was just a nice confirmation for me.
I also like that they did the previously on Discovery in Klingon. That was great.
Yeah, that was cool.
They've done that before. They did that once last season.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was cool.
It was great last season, too.
And I do just want to say Mary Chifo is amazing. Her acting through all of that stuff, and I still wish they could do something about at least the mouth prosthetics so that the Klingons don't all sound like they're talking through stuff, because they are. Except for Kolbosh. Yeah. I can't remember his name. He obviously wasn't wearing a whole lot, you know, other than maybe some teeth. Because he was very clear, and you know, but the stuff they've got going on around their mouths, I really wish they could back off on that, because it's really distracting for me.
It's not as bad as Takuvma.
No.
It has gotten better since then, but.
All right. Well, do we want to talk about what we think is coming up?
I don't really they didn't make a whole lot of steps this week other than the fact that they know that Spock is going after the Red Angels. We already knew that, you know, so I don't think we really learned a whole lot more as far as the overall arc. We just kind of saw some side stuff. Now, there might be some speculation as to what's going to happen with this spore, because they showed in the trailer for next week that Tilly's not completely done with that spore yet. No. It's going to try to reattach it. Itself.
I the only thing that this episode did well, I really hope it's more something I hope they don't do than is something that they might do, is I really hope that they aren't going to say that the child of Volk and Laurel is why more human looking Klingons are in the future.
I thought they might be going there with that, but it's kind of implausible, and we already have the augment running around. So if you're going to stick with, quote, canon, Enterprise already took care of that for us.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. And having, you know, one is not enough. So.
Right, exactly. And especially on a monastery planet.
Yeah. Right.
So am I the only one? I want to go on just a little tangent.
Tangent away.
But this is, it's not so much, I'm not laying this at Discovery's feet. I hate the fact that they've embraced it so wholeheartedly, because this to me is a fad. This is a gimmick that is going to age badly. The whole, we can lift points of light technology thing that the Marvel Cinematic Universe brought to us with Iron Man. Now Burnham is just like, and Spock, they're just throwing data around in the air, and they're able to expand it and shrink it and move it. And how does that work? And I understand it's just like very popular visually these days to do it that way. But I just hate seeing it sneak into Trek.
It makes, if you're in a room that can emit holograms, it makes perfect sense you should be able to do that, as opposed to everybody gathering around a monitor and you got to show, you know, these seven points spread across the cosmos.
Is every room a de facto holodeck then,
apparently?
Well, you know, Voyager had holo emitters, and
Voyager had a holo emitter that finally let the Doctor get out of sickbay.
That came from the 29th century.
Yeah, that came from centuries in the future.
And Voyager's also 100 years from now.
Yeah. It would make more sense to me if they had some kind of tech, like if they were wearing a glove or something that would interact with things.
But okay. You
know, it's all on Spock's tablet, right?
No. Well, and here's the other thing. Now, John, now think about that, because the Spock scene, now you're going back another 20 years and he's able to do it in his bedroom on Vulcan, and the dragon comes out of the tablet.
Yeah.
It's just so, I mean, like I said, it's a small thing. It's just something that I see as a very popular populist kind of effect that is going to make this show look as ridiculous as the original series in 20, 30 years time.
I can't say that you're wrong. It doesn't bother me.
Okay. Tangent over. I'm sorry, guys.
But then they'll be making a series that takes place 10 years before this one. and the technology will be so far advanced that everybody will be complaining that, in Discovery, they just had those holograms. You know, in this, it's like something crazy.
I have a final question, I guess, for Rick. I know you have issues with the concept of Section 31, but as far as how it played in this episode, what were your thoughts?
It was cute. And if they're going to make Section 31 cute, that's even more stupid than having it clandestine.
Tell us how you really feel.
Okay. What it's kind of looking like to me here, maybe, sort of, kind of, is, you know, especially because Ash is like, oh, Section 31, I got the T-shirt. And I honestly don't remember what Discovery did with it. So, you know, canonically, I don't know, and I honestly don't give a shit. I hate Section 31, so that's a given. So anything they do is going to piss me off.
To me, it did not make sense that Ash would even know what Section 31 was. Because
well, that's
he's only.
That's where I'm kind of going with this.
Yeah.
If what they're doing is showing that at this point in time, Section 31 is just the CIA of the Federation, and, you know, their activities are top secret, but the fact that they exist isn't, and that maybe the influence of Georgiou or something, you know, something in the intervening century is, you know, is where we get the twisted evil group that we learn about in DS9. I'm cool with that. Because I've never had a problem with Starfleet having a black ops organization. That's never been my beef with Section 31. My beef with Section 31 is it being answerable to no one and doing things like genocide and, you know, blackmailing Bashir into working for them and you know, all of the crap that they did in DS9, which I still don't know why. You know, and I know that a lot of people embraced it as, yeah, you know, it's unrealistic that this kind of stuff wouldn't happen. Well, Star Trek has never been about being realistic. It's been about being idealistic. And I have learned to let go of that to some extent. but I think the whole idea of Section 31, as it was portrayed in Deep Space Nine, crosses a line I cannot forgive. I cannot cope. I can cope with it. I'll deal with it. I will complain about it. You know, we'll see. You know, when if they do this Section 31 spinoff series, fine. It's, you know, I'll watch it, and they may even make me like it. I don't know. You know, I'm willing to give it a chance. But what we saw at the end of this episode was just this side of the everybody, let's laugh at Spock in the last frame and do a freeze frame as the Enterprise flies off into the, you know, into the sunset. So, you know, if they're going to make Section 31, you know, the F troop of Star Trek, I don't know where I'm going to,
handle that. If a CIA operative goes on a mission, they don't take their name tag that says CIA operative on it in their pocket. You know, she went on a mission, and when she came back, she just reaches in her pocket and pulls out her black badge and shows it to Ash.
She's back on the ship.
It's like, oh yeah, I've heard of the black badges before. You're Section 31. Like, why would she have that with her if she was on a mission?
Exactly.
If she had been captured.
and that's kind of my problem is I don't know that they know what they want to do with Section 31. And it's just ever since DS9 created it, it has just infected every series since, including the JJ verse, where they had to throw it in there, which anyway, that's my take on it. You know, I love Michelle Yeoh.
Oh God, I can't stand her.
I don't particularly care for the character of Empress Georgiou, but at least she was showing some humor in this one for a change. And you know, the gag of her looking longingly at the baby until someone noticed.
I feel that was craft. That was for Ash's benefit, so that he could catch her and she could think, okay, well, she does have a heart in there. I figured that was all her pretending to get him on board. But I could be wrong.
Yeah, I don't know.
I did not buy it.
You know, I will promise this, listeners. I will try my best to stop bitching about Section 31. unless it just becomes really stupid, or we're going to be evil just to be evil. Yeah. We need some mustache twirling, which is what I thought they did in DS9, and which is why I didn't really like it, among other things. Hey, Sean.
Yup.
Sean?
I'm here.
Oh, okay. where can folks find out more about?
Best segue ever.
So good.
More about anything?
About Cosmic Dude, Potato?
The contact information. Keep wrapping up.
All that stuff I can never remember.
Wow. No. CosmicPotato.com. All of our shows are there. And the Facebook page. and a Twitter page. You know, just search for Cosmic Potato and you'll find it. And we have a Patreon page now, too. We actually have a patron. So go to patreon.com/cosmicpotato and find out more about how you can become a patron. And we've got some pretty cool stuff that you can get for donating something to the show and helping out a little bit.
Cool. Well, thank you, everyone. Thank you, Virginia, and happy birthday.
Thank you.
And thank you, John, and happy unbirthday.
Sure.
And thank you, Chris. Where can folks find out more about you, sir?
You can find everything Chris-centric on my website at theflipside.com. That's DeFlipside.com. I especially want to plug a novella that I wrote. It's for sale over there. It's called The Seeker, and it posits what would happen if an invisible man teamed up with a time traveler to defeat a genie. So check that out at theflipside.com. And if you get it and you read it, leave a review on Amazon. For the love of God, please.
All right, and I will have news about where you can find me really soon, but not just yet. But just keep the words infinite diversity in your minds. So thank you, folks, for listening to us. We will be back next week with another show. The title of the next one is one of those, like, Latin-y things. So,
An Obol for Charon.
Oh, right, yeah. So not Latin, Greek. So we will be talking about that once it airs. And so thank you very much for listening. We are done for this week, and we will talk to you later. Take care and bye-bye.